Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The so-called cocaine cowboys ruled Miami, and they would machine gun a whole restaurant and things like that, you know, Scarface type stuff.
Oh, wow.
And I was a crime reporter, so I got to write about a lot of it. And on one hand, it was awful for the community where I grew up. But on the other hand, as a reporter, these were front page stories. These were the big stories of the day.
Hi, this is Christopher Triumph with a new episode of your favorite podcast, Varvet International, or at least I hope it's your favorite podcast. And I was just exploring Staterheim.com. There's so many lovely coats there now. The Inferno Camo, for instance, it's super cool. I might be a little bit too old for that. No, I'm not. It's going to work. And the new Opal, oh my God, that's so cool. It's very glossy, very neat. And of course, the mischievously named Vladimir, colored as the rainbow and in limited edition as well. And some of the proceeds for that go to GLBTQ right organizations. That's so cool too. And a very good cause. So, okay, listener, check out Staterheim.com to find your favorite. And if you don't have a reseller in your town or nearby, there's free shipping all over the world as well. So thank you, Staterheim, for that. And thank you for sponsoring the show. Iconic figures of crime literature for the past few decades, Harry Bosch and the Lincoln Lawyer, sprung out of the imagination and research of best-selling author Michael Connelly. Today, 58 million of his book have sold worldwide, and he has been translated into 39 foreign languages. Let's make that 60 million and 40 languages. Nobody's going to fact check that. I don't know why, but I love late bloomers, perhaps because I am one myself. My career didn't really happen until I was like 38. Michael Connelly started his career quite early on in crime as a crime beat reporter in Florida and later at the LA Times. But he didn't debut as an author until he was in his mid-30s. His in-depth knowledge of the crime on the streets in some of the biggest cities in the US may be what makes his book so engaging and popular. I sat down with Connelly in LA, where he is fully involved in the production of the new TV series based on one of the world's most famous LA detectives, Bosch. And that's in production now, led by one of the showrunners behind The Wire and HBO's Tremé, and is produced by a Swede. Michael Connelly will fill you in a bit, so roll the tape, please. I've been doing this thing instead of a regular sound check. If you could describe the setting or something, or the neighborhood.
We're in the studio area of Los Angeles, very like a block from Paramount Pictures, a place that I've had a up and down relationship with over the years. But I haven't been around here, around Paramount at least, for quite a number of years.
But do you like the neighborhood?
Yeah, I like this neighborhood. It has some secret kind of gems, secret good places to eat and live and so forth. Yeah,
you have a lot going on.
Yeah, these days I'm pretty busy.
Yeah,
it's not, these days it seems like writing books is just a little side part of what else I'm doing.
I'm happy that you could squeeze us in.
Oh, sure.
The Gods of Guilt was just released in Sweden, mm-hmm. actually. And you have a new Harry Bosch coming out.
I'm probably going to finish writing that this week.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Then there's also a little TV series as well.
Yeah, with a little TV series with a big Swedish connection. And looking forward to that. We're going to start making the first season. Right now we're writing scripts.
When did you finish the pilot?
The pilot was shot in November, edited right up until almost the end of January. It was for Amazon Studios, and they put their pilots up for streaming for people to watch and rate and comment on. And so we went through all that process and came out with a lot of very high percentage of five-star reviews. And so Amazon said, let's make a series. Let's go forward with the first season. And that will be 10 episodes. And so we're now in the process of preparing to shoot those.
That's a rather new way of doing television, I guess.
Well, it's Amazon's just gotten into the game last year. They streamed their shows, which is kind of on the, I guess, the front edge of how television is being consumed these days. It's not decided for sure, but my guess is that it will also be dropped all at once. All 10 episodes will go up at once, and people can watch them when they want to and how they want to. And so all that is, I think, new. It's part of television at your own convenience, which on a personal level, I totally subscribe to. That's pretty much how I watch TV. I stream it or I record it and watch it later. I don't really set my schedule by TV schedule. And so I was kind of drawn to this idea because of that, just because of my own personal tastes.
Do you consume TV all legit? Or have you, like, torrented stuff?
Have I what?
Have you?
I think I'm legit.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I stream it through Netflix and Amazon, things like that.
Yeah,
do I go to sites that where it's? I don't even know where those are, so I haven't. And I wouldn't want to do that, especially because now I'm going to be putting a show out there that I'm sure will be pirated to some degree.
You don't actually live in L.A.?
I have a house here, but my permanent residence is in Florida. I lived in L.A. full-time for 15 years, and then about 10 years ago I moved to Florida where I'm from. And I come back all the time to research my books and, you know, just stay, absorb the city, stay close to it. And so I've had places here, but, you know, technically I live in Florida.
But I was thinking about that because it feels like, I mean, your job is so much L.A. related. So you must, even when you're not here, you must be here in mind, sort of.
Yeah, if I'm writing, then I'm thinking about it because my writing's about L.A. But I reached this point where I just felt it would be good to write about L.A. from afar, you know, come here, research, get what I need, and then go 3,000 miles away and kind of look back when I'm writing. Because I'm a pretty fast writer. I'm writing at least one book a year, and I'm always looking for ways to make the experience new and changing it up. And so at one point, about 10 years ago, and I guess it's about 12 now, I said, let's, you know, when I lived here, I moved all around. I lived here 15 years and lived in seven different places in seven different neighborhoods. And then I just reached a point of where I started thinking about a really big move real far away and see what that's like for the writing process. And I actually think it helped, you know, so I didn't come running back 2 years later. It's now going on 12 years, and I still think it works well.
The move, was it related also to, because you have a daughter, right? Mm-hmm. Was it related to her in any way?
Well, when you kind of make a decision or you're heading towards a decision, you find ways of supporting it, you know. And so I like I said, I'm from Florida. My wife's from Florida. At the time, we had parents living, and they were my daughter's grandparents. And so we thought, not only for the creative reason, but for the family reason, my daughter can get to know her remaining grandparents, and that would be a good thing. My wife would be able to be close to her sister and things like that. So you find reasons to support it. So that's what we did.
Are you planning to come back here for permanently?
I don't know about, I wouldn't even make a plan. I don't know what I'll do permanently. I know in this year, I've been out here quite a bit, probably more so than Florida. And that will continue because of the, you know, the television show and those kind of requirements. As long as I think the show is going well, I'm going to be out here a lot.
But the family is still on the East Coast.
Yeah, they're over there. Luckily, the main production of the show is going to be beginning in the summer. So as soon as my daughter gets out of school, my family will be coming out because we have a house here and there's room for everybody.
Okay, cool. You said somewhere that Los Angeles is a city of unrealized dreams.
No, I mean, yeah, I think, and well, that came out of the question is like, why am I interested in Los Angeles? Why are so many people interested in Los Angeles? And I think, you know, part of that answer is that it's a place where people come to try to realize dreams. And there's, you know, not everyone achieves them. No, not everyone has that great moment. And so you have a lot of haves and have nots. And a lot of it, because of maybe the nature of the entertainment industry, is very much played out in public. You see the limousines, you see the premieres, you see things, and especially with the media as it is today, the internet media and so forth, there's really a widening gulf between the haves and have nots in this society, and really particularly in Los Angeles. And I think that is interesting to me, because from that gulf, that span between haves and have not, there's a lot of friction, you know, and I think in that friction is where I find the stories I write about.
But I'm also thinking that I have never lived here. I've just visited. But at a point, I would guess that all those unrealized dreams would sort of be depressing.
I think they can be depressing. Yeah, sure. I mean, especially if that's your dream that's not being achieved. But it's also, you think about the character of someone who will pick up from wherever they're living, where it's not working. I mean, you don't come here because you made all your dreams, or I guess there are some people, but for the most part, people come here because they're missing something wherever it was they were from. That was my story. I grew up in Florida. I wanted to be a writer. I was unable to write books that I wanted to get published. I was struggling, and I came here hoping something would happen. And I was one of the lucky ones. Something did happen, and it worked out. And some of my dreams have been fulfilled, and then some. Yeah, I mean, I think it takes a character, a kind of a character of always plugging away and hoping, all right, it didn't work out this time, but I'm going to try it again. And so there's that kind of personal ethic I think you see a lot in Los Angeles, people who don't give up. And, of course, there are people who give up. There is the as you mentioned, the depression. I think that does overtake many people, and that's part of that gulf that I'm talking about, those that have given up, those who don't have it, and those who do have it.
Do you get to hang out with the ones who didn't succeed as well?
I don't know if I hang out with anybody. As a writer, you know, I'm mostly in a room by myself. But, I mean, I think I certainly see it when you move around the city. I mean, now I'm moving in a world of television where there's, you know, every time you go into a studio to pitch a project, the waiting room is filled with people wanting to pitch their project. And not everyone's going to get picked up. Not everyone's going to get the go-ahead to write a script. And so I think you can call it competition, but you can also look at it in terms of the people who are going to make it and those who are not.
Well, I guess it's hard for you to guess, but would you say that most people in Los Angeles are in a place that they don't want to be in?
No, I wouldn't.
Fair enough. As I said, I'm visiting. What are your watering holes in Los Angeles?
My watering holes?
Yeah.
You mean like bars and stuff? I mean, I don't drink, so I don't go to bars.
Oh, you don't?
No. So,
me neither.
You know, I what I do is I come to Los Angeles to get inspired. And what do? I write books about lawyers and detectives and things like that. So I hang around with people that do these kind of jobs that I write about and kind of wait and hope that I'll see something or I'll hear something or I'll learn a story that inspires me. So I don't know about watering holes, but I know a lot of good places have lunch that are near police stations and courthouses, because that's often where I meet people. And so that's largely what I do. But, you know, at night, more often than not, you'll just find me in my room writing.
Yeah. I'm curious about your name. Is it Scottish or Irish?
Irish, yeah.
Yeah. What's your ancestry?
It's 100% Irish.
Okay.
Yeah, all my grandparents and so forth came from Ireland.
When? At what time?
Well, at different times, but I'm fourth generation. So it'd be like great-grandparents came from Ireland.
Have you been back? Of course you have.
I've been back many times, but mostly on book tours. I've not gone back to research ancestry. That, for some reason, that doesn't intrigue me. I have brothers and sisters who have gone back, and I know the whole story and all that kind of stuff, but I'm not the one who's going back to find it.
Do you have any idea why you don't?
I don't know. I also don't like reading very old books. I'm very contemporary in my interests And I think that has something to do with it. I mean, I love Ireland. It's one of my favorite places to visit. I think Dublin's one of the best cities that I know. But it's just from my experiences as a traveler, not because of my Irish descent or Irish nostalgia. It's just, I don't know, it's just the way I am.
Is it the same with the movies? Is it hard for you to watch movies that don't take place in the present?
Yeah, to a great extent. And I don't know why that is, but here's an example. I was growing up, I loved reading crime fiction and true crime, but I was only reading contemporary stuff. And so that was really kind of a mistake because I missed all kinds of classic writers. And for example, I didn't read any Raymond Chandler, but then I went and saw a contemporary movie based on one of his books. It was set in the 70s, and I watched it in the 70s. And that's how I discovered Raymond Chandler. So then that made me read the books, and then I realized, oh, these books are way older than that movie. But, hey, they're pretty good. And then I read all the books, and, you know, that led me eventually to wanting to be a writer. But for some reason, I'm very much, I guess, of the moment. That's what interests me, what's going on now. And, you know, I know it's a short-sighted view of things because you can certainly learn about what's going on now by what's happened in the past. I get that. And I think that's actually a theme that ends up in my books, even though I don't feel it myself.
Do you feel the same way with music?
Actually, I don't with music for some reason, because I listen to a lot of jazz from the 50s. I don't know. I seem to cherish that period of time in that genre of music. You know, and then probably everyone, I'm afflicted with nostalgia. I listen to on the satellite, you know, 70s on 7 and 80s on 8, you know, that kind of stuff that I grew up with. So it hasn't really hit me on music, but it does hit me with books, television, movies. The other night, you know, there's a classic L.A. film called He Walked by Night, and I think it's 56 or 54, and I wanted to watch it because of a scene I heard about, which is something I wanted to see. It's basically a scene in the tunnels underneath L.A., which I've used in my books, and someone told me you got to watch that movie because of those scenes. It's kind of a connection to your book, so I wanted to watch it, and I basically stopped watching it after I saw those scenes because the movie wasn't gripping to me, and yet it's considered a classic noir film.
Speaking of ancestry, you were born in Philadelphia, right?
Yes.
What do you know about your birth?
Not very much. I know I had thrush mouth. You know what that is?
No.
It's probably called something else now, but in the 50s it was called thrush mouth. That means the baby opened his mouth while he was still in the womb, and liquids went in, and so you get a infection in the throat, and it's called thrush mouth.
Okay.
And I think a thrush is a red bird, so your throat is really red. And so I had to stay extra days in the hospital. That's all I know.
Okay.
I don't remember this, of course, because no. I was one day old.
What did your parents do?
At the time, my mom was a homemaker, and my father worked for his father, and they built houses. They were contractors.
And that was what was set out for you to do as well?
It wasn't necessarily set out. It was something I was moving towards. It wasn't like, you know, my father expected me to join him. I liked doing it. I grew up working for him, you know, on weekends and in high school, and I've always liked being on construction sites, and then you see, you know, something from your labor. You build something, or you build part of that project. And so I liked that, and I liked the idea of fulfillment that would come from it. So that was where I was heading until I got sidetracked by reading Raymond Chandler and other writers.
Because you realized that really early, that was what you wanted to do.
Writing,
yeah.
I don't know if it was that early. I mean, you always hear these writers go, like, I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was 8 or 9. I was a reader, but I didn't know I wanted to be a writer until I was about 19. And I was in college, and I was taking courses for engineering and construction, and I was going down that road, and then suddenly I took that a big turn.
Do you have some of that interest still in you? I mean, with the constructions and stuff?
Yeah, I do. I mean, when my wife and I have bought and renovated several houses in L.A. and in Florida over the years, it seems like we've always done projects, and they're pretty much her job, but I always get involved in terms of design and things like that, and I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah, people tend to not like renovating, but I feel it's so fulfilling when you see it actually happen, when it evolves.
Yeah, I mean, especially if it comes out of your genius or your creativity, and you can see a place for what it could be, not what it is now. I mean, I love that idea, and that's usually what we've done. We did that with two or three homes in Los Angeles, and we've done it now where we live in Florida.
But now you're renting a house here.
My house here is, yeah, a leased house. I'm not going to be able to renovate it. I think about when I'm in there what I would do if I owned it, and I would make changes.
When you changed AIM at 19 then, did you feel that you got support from home?
Yeah, I got, surprisingly, I got an amazing amount of support for reasons I didn't really understand at the time, and that was that my father had a creative streak in him, and he had entertained ideas of being a painter when he was about the same age, and he had gone to a prestigious art school in Philadelphia to learn to be a painter, but because of the time and because he was having a family, he had to make a living, and so he followed his father into building homes and never got back to that painting idea. So when I came around the same age and said, I want to pursue this creative idea I have, rather than him saying, no, you can't, you have to make a living or blah, 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 he said, that's great. How do we get you to that point? And so it actually was he and with me kind of schemed on how I would get into a position to someday take a shot at writing books.
How long did you live in Philadelphia for?
Till I was 12.
What can you tell me about that place back then?
I lived in the suburbs. I lived in a series of suburbs because my father, you know, would build houses, and he and his father would build seven or eight houses at once. They'd buy a big piece of land and kind of build a little neighborhood. And so we would move according to where those projects were. So I moved around a lot. And so what I remember about it, which is not a lot, you know, I don't think I didn't drive there. I left before I was a driver. And I always think that if you drive in an area, you get to know it. So I don't really feel I knew Pennsylvania a lot. But the one thing that I think was very important that happened was all this moving around made me kind of introverted because, like, you know, I didn't have deeply connected friends because we would move. So I became a reader, and so I spent a lot of time by myself reading. And I think that was, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be sitting here. You know, I think that reading, the baseline of being a voracious reader was needed for eventually the thought to strike that said, hey, I want to try to do this. I want to try to write these kind of stories, not just read them.
Who were you in school then, perhaps when you moved at 12? Were you well received?
Whenever you move, there's cliques and friendships are already made, so you're always going to be an outsider. You can make friends. I made friends, you know, a few friends wherever I went, but nothing that would have been the same as if this had been your whole life. You'd been at the school for 10 years or 8 years or whatever. That just wasn't the experience I had.
Are you bitter for that?
No. I mean, it wasn't fun when I went through it, but, you know, lots of kids go through it. It's not a unique experience. And now I look back at it and realize that if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. It takes, I think, somebody who's an introvert, somebody who's a voracious reader to end up doing what I'm doing. And all that came out of this kind of lifestyle of moving.
Did you get to go to prom and stuff?
I never went to a prom. I never went to a homecoming. And it's funny, I have a 17-year-old daughter now who struggles with that kind of stuff. And like, will she go to prom and that? And I know it's difficult for her, but I also have this long-range view about how it's not really, doesn't really matter.
Well, I hope it solves itself for her.
Yeah.
You said that you and your father made a scheme?
A plan. You know, it just sounds like, it sounds too good. I mean, it was a long shot no matter what. But I went home for a weekend from college to say, I want to change my major to creative writing from engineering, big change. And by the time I headed back to school 3 days later, I was going back to enroll in journalism, not creative writing. And that was what came out of that discussion. It's like, not only do you want to be a writer, but you want to write about these worlds, these specific worlds, the world about crime and detectives and lawyers and things like that. So why don't you go into journalism and get a position, hopefully, where this is the kind of people that you deal with, that you write about, that you talk to, that you get to know, and that would help you hopefully be in a position to someday write about them in terms of fiction and character. And that was a pretty astute observation for him and for me to agree, I guess, you know, when I'm 19. But that was where the scheme came in. It was like he was really big on saying, how do you position yourself to take that shot? If you go into creative writing, what do? You graduate and then start writing books, or do you teach English, or, you know, what do you do with creative writing? Whereas if you went into journalism, you could get a job on a newspaper and really get a rich variety of exposure to things. And hopefully, and one of those things would be what you want to write about, the criminal justice world. And it turns out that's what it was. You know, I was able to get on a police beat, and more or less stay there. I worked at, you know, three different papers, but at each of the papers, I was able to get that job and keep it.
So it worked out perfectly then.
Yeah, and it does make it, when you look back at it, it looks like, wow, what genius, what a master plan, what a scheme. And it really wasn't. It was more like a hopeful thing. And the other thing is that a job in journalism is a pretty interesting job. Say I never wrote a book, I'd probably still be pretty happy, because I think I would be seeing things in the world that few other people get, and having great experiences. So there was also that aspect of it that this might put you in a position to take that shot, but even if it doesn't, you'll be writing. You said you want to be a writer, and you'll be having probably a rich and varied professional life. So it was kind of like one of those, they didn't use the phrase back then, but a win-win proposition.
What was it called back then?
I don't know. Sounds like a plan. I don't know what we would call it.
Did you have, like, in college or so, because you were sort of an outcast in high school, mm-hmm. did you get to bloom socially at any
time?
Yeah,
I think I did. You know, I went on my first dates in college. By virtue of the way it's set up with dorms and so forth, I went to a college at 25,000 students, but it was knocked down to a microcosm of everyone on my hallway, and you did stuff together. And I was there for all my college. I didn't move around or anything like that. So it was really probably the first time in my life I had some stability in terms of where I was for a while. So it worked out pretty good. Also, when you get that point, you get to that point where you have that kind of direction, you've had like the lightning strike you and you suddenly know very fervently, I want to be a writer. How do I get there? That's when schooling and things really become pretty wonderful, you know, and you're picking what you're looking at, what you're studying. You're knowledgeable about teachers. And, you know, I had teachers who had written books that were published authors, and I had never seen anyone like that before. So it was a very exciting time and fruitful in terms of, I think, the blooming of my creativity.
Did you write books back then also?
No, not in college. You know, I would go on, I changed my major to journalism, so most of the writing I was doing was journalism. I didn't attempt to write fiction till pretty soon after, maybe within a year after graduating, and I was working at a newspaper, I was starting to write fiction at night. It wasn't anything that anyone ever read or I ever sent out. It was all kind of the learning process. And I wrote, in a space of about 6 years, I wrote two books that I've never let anyone read. I've never sent them. They weren't good. They weren't worthy of being published. But the second one was a lot better than the first one, so I could see progress.
And do you still have them?
Yeah, they're like, you know, in stores somewhere.
So at some time, maybe people will get to read them.
I don't think so, because I've actually taken measures in my will and so forth to say they shouldn't be published.
Okay. Cool.
And they're not even based in Los Angeles, because I was working in Florida, and, you know, it doesn't make sense to go back to see the worst stuff you've ever written.
No.
You know, even if you're dead and you're not around to have people say, hey, this is the worst stuff he's ever written. I'd rather not just go away.
Yeah. What was your first paid writing job?
I worked for the college newspaper, so they didn't pay a lot, but they paid.
And then after college?
I went to work for a newspaper. So I've been paid professionally as a writer of some kind, you know, since I was 20. I'm 58 now, so 38 years. I didn't make any money on fiction till I was 35.
But you got to actually write about crime and cover mm-hmm. crime in Florida.
Yeah.
What was the crime situation like?
It was pretty crazy because it was early 80s, and it was when cocaine was king and right before the crack epidemic. And South Florida was a major place where cocaine and other drugs came in. And that created a real aura of violence. You know, the so-called cocaine cowboys ruled Miami, and they would, you know, machine gun a whole restaurant and things like that, you know, Scarface type stuff.
Oh, wow.
That was all going on there. And I was a crime reporter, so I got to write about a lot of it. And on one hand, it was awful for the community where I grew up. But on the other hand, as a reporter, these were front page stories. These were the big stories of the day. How lawless it felt at times in Miami and South Florida.
Did you early on find a way of not getting emotionally involved in that? Or how does it work? Because you get to see really bad stuff, I guess.
Well, you don't see as much as people think. A lot of it is you're removed from it because you're a reporter. I mean, the cops see it every day. You do a lot of stuff by telephone. So there are buffers. I did have instances where I would write or ride along with homicide detectives and see things that were pretty bad. But I don't know, maybe from being around, I think police officers kind of build a shell around them, and maybe that helped me seeing what they did. I adapted that. I don't really know.
Have you seen dead people?
Have I seen dead people, yeah.
Early on?
Yeah. Yeah, well, from being a newspaper reporter, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the early stories, there was a period of time where because of, can't think of the guy's name, but anyway, a very violent and brutal ruler in Haiti, people were getting on the worst kinds of boats and just trying to get to Florida, Haitian refugees, and many of them didn't make it. Their boats capsized in storms, and wrote several stories about like 20 dead people washed up on the beach. And, you know, going to the beach and seeing them all over the beach is pretty awful. But, yeah, I mean, that was part of, if you were the police reporter, you covered all levels of crime. It wasn't just murders. It was accidents, and it was, you know, bad stuff. So, that was part of the job.
Yeah. Did that affect you?
I think it affects me to the point that I can, just talking about that story now, about the Haitian refugees, I remember the name of their boat, everything. You know, so that was a story from 1981. So whatever that is, you know, 35 years later, I can picture it perfectly in my head. So I guess it did leave a searing memory.
Yeah, of course. You said earlier that you moved here, but did you get picked up by the LA Times from your job in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, two things were going on. I had written those books privately. No one knew about it other than my wife. And so I had the second one was better than the first, but the second one still wasn't good enough. And so I've often felt in my life the need to change things. And so I thought it's time to make, if I'm gonna, you know, I can't keep trying to write books and not have it happen. I felt, you know, my wife and I wanted to start a family. We hadn't done that yet because I was writing at night, and we had made a deal that I would have a chance to write a book and get it published. And so I realized I was running out of time, and I thought I could try one more time. And if it didn't work and I couldn't get it published, then it was time to think about just being a newspaper reporter and starting a family. So for that last time, I felt I should really change things around. And you know, I had lots of good stories, lots of good clips, as they say in the newspaper business. I thought I could get a job somewhere else. So I sent to three places that were of interest to me: Chicago, Denver, Colorado, and Los Angeles. And basically my idea was I'd go to the first place that would take me. And I was lucky that it happened in Los Angeles.
How did you choose those three places?
Well, I worked for a paper that was owned, the mother paper was the Chicago Tribune. And I'd been there like on business several times and liked the city. And I thought, you know, because it was a corporate connection, that I had a good chance to go there. I had some family in Denver, and I'd gone out there skiing and so forth, and I liked that. And then Los Angeles I'd never been to, but I loved it through fiction and some films. And as a writer, the person I was trying to emulate the most was Raymond Chandler, and he wrote about Los Angeles. Another writer who was super influential was Joseph Wambaugh, and he wrote about Los Angeles. And so I picked Los Angeles just because of that, this idea that the writers who most inspired me wrote about that place, so there must be something about that place that hopefully would rub off on me. And so I sent to these places. I interviewed in all the cities, and the first one to call me and say, we'd like to offer you a job, was the Los Angeles Times, so I took it.
What was the difference in what you covered here? I mean, what was the situation, the job situation, basically? What was the difference?
The big difference was, I mean, Los Angeles and South Florida had similarities in this kind of destination city. Most people from South Florida weren't born there. They came there. Same thing with Los Angeles. So there was a correlation or a connection that was similar. Los Angeles is much bigger geographically, much bigger sprawl. It's also much more diverse nature-wise. It's got mountains, it's got deserts, it's got oceans. South Florida is basically ocean and beach. And so that was a big difference. I think the diversity of the people was greater out in Los Angeles. As far as the work on a newspaper, it was also spread out. Like, I worked at papers that had one office, basically, or one or two offices. And Los Angeles Times had offices everywhere. I started out on the far edge of the city, out in a place called Chatsworth. And you can't get any further away and still be in the city. You know, so it was a big change. Even though the stuff I was writing about was fairly much the same, you know, drug murders and there's a similarity in crimes, the place was quite different. And from that, I thought that was exciting. I think maybe what hurt me was when I got out of school, I ended up working for the newspaper where I grew up. And so it was like a place I knew, you know, since I was 12 years old. I knew it like the back of my hand. And what coming to Los Angeles and not knowing it at all really helped me. And, you know, going out in the stories almost, you know, the first couple of years, almost every time I would go out on a story, I'd go to a neighborhood I'd never been to before. And that was all invigorating. It was just helped me creatively. And very quickly, after moving here, less than a year, I started writing a book again, taking that third chance. And that became the first Harry Bosch book, and it got published. Mm. And I think it was because of this creative excitement I was feeling about being in a new place and being in the place that had inspired the writers that meant the most to me.
Was cocaine the main thing here as well?
Well, by then, I came to Los Angeles in the, it was 87. And so we were moving into the crack epidemic. And so that crack was really a motivator for a lot of the crime I was writing about in Los Angeles.
Is crack and cocaine related?
Yeah, crack is a form of cocaine that's been, they call it rocked up. It's been, I can't remember what the process is, but you put chemicals in it, it becomes hard, and you smoke it as opposed to sniffing it. And it's more intense and it's more addictive. And when that invaded some of the communities of Los Angeles, it gave rise to all the violence. You know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, they would have up to 800 murders a year in Los Angeles. I think last year they had 230. So it was just a very violent time when I came here. And on one hand, that's absolutely horrible for a community. But from the standpoint of being a crime reporter, it was amazing. Every day there would be an interesting story to write about, an interesting murder. There's stuff happening all the time. In fact, there were so many murders we couldn't even write about them. That's how crazy it was. So we'd have an editor. I'd go to him and say, well, we've had six murders. This is this one. This is that one. And he'd say, all right, write about those two and the other ones, forget them. And so it's really a newspaper making a editorial decision on the value of people. You know, this person is not worth being written about. It's really kind of cynical and strange.
What defined a good murder in the newspaper world?
Oh, just anything. If it was just like another shootout over a rock of crack, well, we've written tons of those stories. So I think editors were always looking for something new, a new angle and an old wrinkle kind of thing. Anything intriguing on how the investigators approach the case. anything that involved, you know, a lot of murders happen and arrests aren't made right away. Anytime that, there was a murder and an arrest, that would get bumped up to a story level. But it, a lot of times there'd be, you know, so-and-so was shot in a drive-by. He was involved in the drug trade. Those kind of stories, there had been dozens and dozens of those written. And so I think those were the kind that would get last place in the rankings of whether we write about them.
I guess that you were pretty good at your job.
I was good at aspects of my job. I've never looked back at myself as a reporter and said I was like the best or anything like that. I mean, there's two kinds of writer reporters. One is a great digger and a person who can create and procure a network of sources that help them get stories that no one else has. And then there's great writers, the people who can take the facts that are procured by themselves or by a partner and write a really intriguing and gripping story.
And I would guess that you're the second.
I would say I was the second. I mean, I think that's where I was good. If I had the facts, I could write a story that people would want to read to the end. But getting those facts, I wasn't the best at it. And, you know, what was beneficial at a place like the Los Angeles Times where I worked was that it was a huge place, and they rarely, any kind of big story would have more than one reporter on it. And so you end up kind of dividing responsibilities, and I was known as the guy who would be the writer. And, you know, I did do reporting and stuff like that, but for the most part, I was the finesse guy, and someone else was the gatherer.
Did you type on typewriters back then?
No.
It was computer.
Yeah. I've always, I graduated from college in 1980, and from my first job, I used a computer. I mean, they were pretty archaic computers, but I never worked on a typewriter.
Okay. You've spent your whole career writing about crime, and both as a journalist and a novelist, but would you say that the American justice system is working?
It works. I don't know if it's working well. I mean, it's definitely a damaged system. I think that's pretty clear from any sampling or survey of television news or a newspaper or something. You see the cracks where people fall through. You see the cracks where people run through. If you read my books, I think you see characters who take a broken system and use the cracks or the breakpoints to their advantage, who know their way around a broken system. But that's one question. Another question is, you know, would it be better if we had a different system? And I think the answer is probably no. The system probably does not work 100% at all. There's many, many examples of where it has failed and failed in really horrible ways. But, you know, at the same time, can I come up with a better system? I you know, not that I'm any kind of great legal mind or anything like that, but I can't really think of a better way of doing it.
Okay, but within the system then, would it be possible to make changes to make the situation better? Because I would assume that you still have quite a lot of crime here.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know. These are like huge questions that I'm never going to have the right answers to. But there's two things. One is the prevention of crime, and then one is the prosecution of crime. And the prosecution of crime is where, let me go back up. As far as the prevention of crime goes, I don't know what can be done. I mean, we have police forces. You can always say, okay, we'll double the number of LAPD cops on the street, and maybe it will push down the crime rate. I'm sure it will, but there's a practical reality to things. If you double the size of the police department, who pays for that? And will people, wealthy people out in Malibu who are not having crime issues, want to double their city taxes? No, they're not. So there's a reality, and there's you know, like the dreamlike responses to how you fix things. As far as the prosecution of crime, it's a system that can be tilted by money, can be tilted by race, it can be tilted by a lot of things, and these are really intrinsic to it. So how do you take the influence of money out of a justice system where it's founded on this idea that if you're accused of a crime, you're entitled to the best defense possible, and if you have the money, you can get the best lawyer possible? So how do you change that? Do you say all lawyers make the same amount of money and you don't get to choose your lawyer? That really kind of undercuts what the system is based on. And so you can definitely sit here and come up with examples and enlist the problems in the system, but solving them that is a tremendous task that, you know, from my cynical point of view, I don't see it being possible. Maybe that's why I write about it. I think my books do have a certain, you know, cynical view of the world. And usually within that cynical view of the world is a hopeful person, you know, someone like Harry Bosch, who understands the frailties of the system and the ways it doesn't work, but he's there plugging away, you know, hoping for the best and doing his best and being dedicated. And, you know, I think that kind of wins the day in these books.
But I'm curious because, well, I come from Sweden. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been to Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've been there a couple times.
Yeah, for book tours.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But we, of course, have class differences as well. But I would say that when it comes to income and so forth, the spread between the most poor and the most rich is so much bigger here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that if that gap would shrink, do you think there would be less crime?
Yeah, I think, as we said at the beginning of the conversation, that the widening space between the haves and have-nots is where you can find, I think, the cause for most of society's ills. So, I mean, if you brought that better, more together, I think you would see some of this crime and so forth depressed.
But there's no real solution to that, or
well,
you can't see one.
I don't see one in this country, because then you start having people scream socialism and all these things that the country is based against. You know, you just see what happens when they try to put out a universal medical coverage bill and the battles that go on that. It's just, I don't think it's reality to think that the people in the one percenters, as they're called, are going to share their wealth, because there's an entitlement to it. They believe they've earned it, and so on and so forth. Like, you know, I'm not going to get into all their philosophies on why they shouldn't share.
Are you in the 1%?
I probably am,
yeah.
But I don't look for ways of not paying my taxes or anything like that. I mean, I feel like I'm very lucky. I don't know if I'm in my 1%. If I am, or I'm very close to it, I'll say that. But it's not something that when you start out to be a writer, you would ever think you're going to end up in. And so I'm not comfortable in it, you know, and I have financial advisors and so forth that can tell me all these different ways of avoiding paying taxes. Like, now I can't think of his name, the guy who ran against Obama the last time, but I just don't pursue that. I have a personal philosophy that is ingrained with these things we're talking about the haves and have nots. So I give my fair share.
Do you do charity as well?
Yeah.
In what way?
I have a thing called Hieronymus Charities, and we it's a foundation, and it's mostly stuff I go looking for, but I tithe a percentage of my income into it, and then it's actually quite fulfilling to then use that money in ways, usually something that struck me. I mean, we do get some applications from people and or organizations and so forth that need help, and we consider that. But I would say for the majority, it's things that my wife and I or family members come upon ourselves to do.
Such as?
Well, most of it's like education. We're lucky that we send our kid, we have one kid, one daughter, to a very good private school, but we also send some underprivileged kids to the school as well. We seek them out through the help of the school and so forth. We take care of, we always give back to places that have given to us, like our own schooling, the college I went to, you know, I do things with them. Very supportive of the LAPD Foundation, which is a kind of the charitable branch of the LAPD, which never has enough money in the budget for equipment and things like that. I mean, you know, many LAPD detectives and others have helped me with my books in terms of advice and expertise and so forth, and like to give back any in any area, but we're talking about LAPD, that has helped me.
Mm. You had some rather complicated issues to get the TV series Vash made, rights-wise. Could you tell us or the listeners about that?
In the early 90s, I was writing these books. I'd written a couple of the Harry Bosch books. I was working full-time as a newspaper reporter, and I just instinctively knew that if I could get away from my daytime job and just be a full-time focus on my books, they were going to improve, because it's obvious that if you're writing for a few hours and then you have to put it down to go to work for the newspaper for the next 8 or 10 hours, this disruption of creative focus is going to have a price to it. And so I was looking for ways of getting away from that. I was definitely reaching my goal when I was 19 of being a writer, and I wanted to keep at it. So when Hollywood came around and was interested in the Harry Bosch books I had written at that time, which is only two, I took their money, and it was a deal I took mostly for the money, not because of the creative aspects of the deal. I knew that money could mean I could go into my boss's office and say I quit. And so I did it. And I don't regret that, no matter what happened over the next 20 years. But what happened over the next 20 years was there was about a 4 or 5 year space of where this place right down the street from where we're talking here, Paramount, made many efforts to make a movie out of these books and Harry Bosch. They hired some really top-notch screenwriters. They had six different scripts written. They had brought me in to rewrite some scripts, to advise on some scripts. So there was a concerted effort to come up with a script that was Harry Bosch, and that would be worthy of making the film. But they never were worthy of making the film. They just never quite captured the character. I mean, Harry, especially in the early books, is very internal. It's a lot about what's going on in his head, and that's really hard to get into a script. And so they did a smart thing, and that was they decided not to do it, and they shelved it. And then comes the 10 or 12 years of frustration for me. I kept writing Harry Bosch books. The series grew and went from being obscure to being a bestseller to being a number one bestseller every time a Harry Bosch book came out. But I couldn't get the rights to the character back from Paramount off the shelf.
Yeah, because they had bought not only the two first books, but also the character.
Yeah, and it was a good enough deal. Like I said, I don't really regret this because it got me to become a full-time writer. But they owned the books, and that was just going to go on. There was one kind of asterisk in the deal, one little clause that said after 15 years I could negotiate to get the rights back. And so that after 15 years, that's what I did. I'm sorry, it was after 12 years. 12 years after concerted efforts to make a movie stopped, I could do this. And then it became a question of when did they stop? And there's all these kind of legal ramifications and it involved a lawsuit and so forth. And eventually I got the books back just I guess it's going on 3 years ago. And this was in the media. It was kind of played out. So one of the people who knew what was going on and was the first one to knock on my door, so to speak, once I had the books back, was the Swedish guy named Henrik Basten, who had a company here in Hollywood called, it was called something else then, but now it's called Fabrik. And he knew the books really well. He had read the books. He could, as an author, you know when people have read your books or not. You know, people can say they have, and they can... You kind of develop this ability to know whether people are legitimately readers of your work or not. And I knew almost right away he was totally legit. And what his idea was for the show would match mine. And that is not like, you know, Harry Bosch Mystery of the Week, but a long serialized story. And so he was basically the first guy to knock on my door, and I made a deal with him.
Mm. Once you got the rights back, there was something about a check.
Oh, that I paid? Yeah,
yeah.
I had to pay to get the rights back. Yeah, ultimately, the agreement involved me paying Paramount more than $1 million. And so I had to sit there and say, is this worth it? And one of my closest advisors has been my longtime editor and now publisher of my books. And I said, you know, if you hit the lottery, so to speak, and you have success on TV, you'd make that money back right away. not right away, but very quickly. But there was a gamble, you know. I mean, this is a detective story. There's detective stories all over every channel. You know, I think it's about a unique detective. But I had to, once I got to the point where Paramount basically said, okay, you can have the books back, this is the price. And I had to decide, do I want to pay that price? And, you know, in talking to people that I'm close to, the people who I value, everyone said I wouldn't bet against you on a deal like this. And I had this guy, the Swedish guy, Henrik, saying, we want to do this, and I really think we can do something good. And I went ahead and did it. I wrote that check, which was pretty tough to do. Sit there and actually write that on a check. And, you know, I haven't regretted it, and especially now that I know we're going to get a minimum one season, I know I'm going to break even at least. So I think the gamble has worked out, at least on that level. And but we'll see. I mean, hopefully Harry Bosch will have a long life on Amazon TV, and it'll end up being not only a break even, but a thing that is successful and will help me do other things.
Are you happy with how it came out, the pilot?
Yeah, I mean, it's been my experience when I've watched TV that there's so many things that have to be done, so many balls in the air on a pilot, that usually a show finds its own in the episodes after the pilot. And I think that will be the case with Harry Bosch. I mean, I'm really happy with the pilot, mostly because the actor, Titus Welliver, I think is a perfect Harry Bosch. And so he stands out as, you know, this is what we're presenting in the pilot. Some of the machinations and mechanics of what goes on in the pilot, you know, I think we missed some stuff. I think we'll, when we get into production, we're going to be able to massage that and shoot a few more scenes for the pilot, and it'll become better. We've already pretty much outlined the season, so I know where we're going, and I know what's going to happen, and I really think the show will take off from the pilot and get better.
So when working with television, you do actually outline?
Yeah, I don't outline. It's been an amazing journey, because I don't outline my books, and I don't put stuff on the walls, and I don't talk about it. I just sit there and do it, and I make mistakes, and I rewrite, and I finally get to, you know, the words, the end. And that's how I've been doing it for 20 years, and now I'm very intimately involved in this television process. And we have 8 writers, and we sit around a big room with a big table, and all the walls are covered with cards showing the different beats and steps of the stories, and we all talk it out. And I went into that thinking, I can't work like this. This is going to be pretty weird. But it turned out to be really, really interesting and really fulfilling. And it's really made me think about, maybe, as I said earlier, I'm always looking for a change. I'm always looking for new inspiration. And so I might change the way I construct my books after this.
Back just shortly to the writing process. I've understood that you have some routines that you, as you said, you have to, like, blindfold the writing room and so forth.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I like, back when I was doing 2 jobs, newspaper by day and books by night, I wrote in the middle of the night, basically. I don't know why, maybe because it was successful eventually. I try to recreate that aura. So now I'm basically a daytime writer, but I have actually had installed in my rental house here in LA, but basically in my main writing room and at home in Tampa, Florida, I have blackout shades and no clocks, and I write by a lamplight and things like that. And it's just, I think psychologically, it's just, I'm trying to recreate those early days when everything was really felt new and fulfilling and so forth. It's a lot different now that I've written 25 books and I've been doing it for 25 years. You know, so I think I'm just trying to recreate those early days.
Do you turn off your phone and so forth?
I usually leave it in another room. Yeah, I mean, I try to make it like, you know, a little dark cube that no one can penetrate. But, you know, that's the best case scenario. The reality is, like, you know, you're going to hear from your editor or something, so you want to have the phone nearby and stuff like that.
I also understood that you drink an awful amount of iced tea while writing. Do you make that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was drinking so much of it, and I was so particular about it that I ended up getting like a restaurant brewer and installed it in my house, and I brew iced tea a few times a week, and very particular about it.
What's the Michael Connelly recipe for a perfect iced tea?
It's a little bit of, I can't really make a recipe, but you know, you brew with these big bags of tea leaves. And I do mix decaf and caffeinated together. I don't go for any kind of fruit flavors or anything like that, although I do put lemon in it. But it's really about that brewing process and, you know, the mix of the two different tea leaves.
Do you use real sugar?
No.
Okay, so it's unsweetened?
Unsweet, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Why is that cool?
Oh, I don't know. It just felt different for a Swede. I think that my perception of iced tea, we're not that big into that. We don't really have that back home. But you have these like pre-mixed bags.
Right.
And they're always sweetened.
Oh, okay.
Do you believe in God?
I believe in a spirituality. I've not made a final decision yet on, like, say, like, where we go when we die. I mean, I believe there's something else. But the word God has so much involved in it that I hesitate to say, yeah, I believe in God. I believe, you know, I believe in things like karma and spirituality, and I think I practice them. So it must be for some kind of greater good or greater goal.
You said early on that you don't drink. Why is that?
Well, it's a kind of a recent thing in my life, but a lot of it has to do with the opportunities I've been given in the last couple of years and not wanting to basically screw them up and wanting to be completely on my game and alert at all times. Just, you know, nothing bad happened. I didn't get a DUI or anything like that. It's just a personal choice. And maybe it has something to do with I'm about to turn 58. My father died when he was 59. And, you know, being kind of wanting to be as healthy as I can.
And do you work out?
Yeah.
How?
I have a gym in my garage, and I have a trainer come 3 times a week.
Okay, that's good. You are one of the most read authors in the world, but maybe the last 10 years or so, the Scandinavians have been like catching up on mm-hmm. you. Are you feeling threatened?
No, I mean, the good thing is about books is that no one reads just one. I mean, it's not like you buy a car and then you got that car for a year. Writing begets writing, you know. If you're thrilled by a book, you're going to look for another one because you want that experience again. And, you know, you just don't stay with just one writer. Yeah, you might be loyal and read everything this one writer has done and will do, but you're always going to expand your universe. So I think when I hear or know of, like, a writer I've never heard of suddenly capturing the zeitgeist of writers, I mean, of readers, I think, cool. Because I think they'll eventually come around and find my books.
Mm. Would you like to recommend anything?
This is a kind of an odd recommendation. I'll recommend a movie that's about 20 years old, but I just rewatched it, and it's about LAPD detectives, but not so much about LA. It's about them going away to work on a case in the south of the United States, and it's called One False Move. And it was actually written by Billy Bob Thornton.
Okay.
And it's a small movie, no movie stars or anything like that, but it's a very cool movie. I think it's about 20 years ago old.
Maybe we can find it on Pirate Bay.
Don't tell them why, Sandy.
No. Did you see True Detective?
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I really loved it.
Yeah.
And I think it's we're working in the same kind of vein. So when I saw that, I was encouraged, you know, because there's an easy... There's kind of a quick response from, I think, mostly uninformed people that, like, oh, no, not another detective story. And it's like any kind of story. It's like they used to say, oh, no, not another serial killer story. But then Silence of the Lambs was a serial killer story that everyone had to see. So as soon as you do something well, it doesn't really matter what's come before it or how much of else other variations of it is out there. If you do something within an established thing, True Detective is certainly... an established paradigm, but the characterizations of writing and so forth, you know, took it to a new level. And so I really loved it and was encouraged by it. You know, it's the writer behind it was first a book writer, and I think it comes out in its 8 episodes much like a book. And that's what we hope to do with Bosch. So you know, at the same time, whether I was in this business or not, I would have loved that show. I think I loved it even more knowing what we were trying to do.
Who would you like me to interview on the Varvet International?
I don't know. I mean, I like, you know, I'm drawn towards the obscure, so not the obvious type choices. I think just take L.A. here. There's a writer, I think his fourth book's about to come out, so he's kind of new on the scene, last maybe 5 years, named P.G. Sturgis. And his take on L.A. is pretty unique within the genre of crime. And he writes about a guy called the Shortcut Man. And I think he's a pretty good stylist, pretty interesting stylist. And he also came to this late. And I read his author thing on the back, and he had been in the Navy in an atomic submarine. He'd been in a rock band. He had a very varied life before, probably in his 50s, he started writing these books. And so I think that would be a pretty interesting interview.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, that's the lovely Michael Connelly for you. And the latest news that I hear about the TV series Bosch is that it's premiering in early 2015 on Amazon TV. And you can already now pre-order his new Bosch book, The Burning Room, and it's online somewhere. But it's coming out any day now in November. So go buy that, and I'll talk to you in a week. But before that, I have to tell you that the crew doing this is myself, Christopher Triumph. My producer is Christina Görling Biro, and the editor is Lovisa Olsson. And the show is sponsored by Stutterheim.com. It's a fantastic site. Go look at it now and try to go there without wanting to buy something. I dare you. Talk to you in a week. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.